This is May 11th, 2014, and today I'm going to talk about kindness. Reading from an article that appears in the current Shambhala Sun, May 2014. Shambhala Sun is one of the three glossy Buddhist magazines that has a national circulation. The others are Tricycle and Buddha Dharma. This is an interview of George Saunders, who has gotten quite acclaimed as a writer of short stories, mainly, I think. Last year, he was on the cover of New York Times Magazine, kind of a provocative title where they said that the best writer in America. I'll just read some of the run-up to the interview. And I guess this the interviewer is Melvin McLeod. He says, "Our deep longing for kindness is reflected in the surprising response to a simple 8-minute convocation speech. It was delivered by the great American writer George Saunders," and it lists here some of his works, 10th of December, it's a collection of short stories, Civil War Land in Bad Decline, and Pastoralia. Anyway, delivered by the American writer to last year's graduates of Syracuse University, where he teaches. 3 months after he gave the speech, a transcript was published on the New York Times website, and it went viral. And now just to kind of summarize the next paragraph or two, what he told these graduates at Syracuse started with a story about a shy girl in his seventh grade class by the name of Ellen and his failure to be kind to her. It goes on to say his meditation on such failures of kindness and why they're our greatest regret is now a small inspiring book entitled Congratulations, by the way, Some Thoughts on Kindness. When I spoke to Saunders, he was shy about his unexpected role as a spokesman for kindness and humble, unnecessarily so, about his Buddhist practice. But in an era when values like kindness and compassion are often put down, he's talking thoughtfully and bravely about what needs to be at the very core of our lives and our society. Just a personal note, I know George a little bit. I've been at a couple of dinner parties with him, and I have to say he's enormously impressive guy, impressive in his not impressiveness, his simplicity and his emptiness. This is always the highest compliment in Zen. It's just no affectation, nothing special. There's a transparency of certainly a humility, very, very impressive humility to him. He just is sort of at these gatherings, he's just sort of invisible, soft-spoken. So he's a real model of practice, and very hesitant to even mention his own practice, as you'll hear in this interview. At one of these things, his wife was there too, and she also is very devoted to Dharma practice, Tibetan Buddhist practice, so much so that she lived apart from him at a Tibetan Buddhist training center of some kind for a good length of time, months if not years. Last I heard, they were she'd move back with him, but they're both really impressive people. So the first question, how did you decide on the theme of kindness for your convocation speech? And he says, I first gave a version of his speech to my daughter's middle school graduating class. I'm going to be having to skip around as usual, just try to hit the meat of the article. The only advantage I had over them was about 40 years of living. When I looked through those 40 years, I found I didn't really regret that much. But there was one thing that seemed urgent to say. I wanted to tell them that if I could go back in time, there was one thing I really would change. The times in my life when, because of anxiety or fear, I missed a chance to say a kind word or help somebody out. Scanning the horizon of my life, those were the deeply regretted bumps in the road I wish I could go back and change. Notice he goes right to the heart of the matter. He says, because of anxiety or fear, he failed at a failure of kindness. I think we never want to lose sight of is that no one, or I don't know no one, but it's hard to imagine there are many people in the world who are evil or cruel all the way through. Most people, let's put it that way, most people who have failures of kindness, I think he's right, is because of some kind of a fear. But he develops that more. Questioner, the personal failure of kindness you talk about involved Ellen, a girl in your seventh grade class who was being bullied. You weren't mean to her yourself, but you failed to be kind to her. And then George's response. Originally, the conceit of the speech was, what do I remember of being in the seventh grade? But there really was nothing except this one thing, which stung. When I was a kid, I was a very enthusiastic Catholic, and this was the first time I felt myself fall away from myself. I kind of knew what Jesus would have done in that situation, but in the heat of the moment, I thought, I can't do that. That's too hard. It's like I was watching myself and was a little disappointed that I had failed in that way. Question, if failures of kindness are our greatest regret, is that because being kind is our greatest aspiration, our deepest heart's wish? And then he responds, and it's our greatest ecstasy. Those times when the differentiation between yourself and another person vanishes in a kind of spontaneous moment of outreach are deeply, deeply rich. If you cast your mind toward the people in your life who've been kindest to you, you feel an incredible rush of warmth and gratitude that never goes away. I dedicated this book on kindness to my grandparents who believed in me no matter what I did. Not for any objective reason, but just because I was me. They knew me inside and out and nevertheless approved of me. I think that creates a kind of gratitude you never forget. There's a phrase that appears in the Mumonkan. This is by the 11th century master Mumon of grandmotherly kindness. It's one that I remember hearing Roshi Kaplow use. It sort of has this ambiguous quality to it grandmotherly or grandfatherly kindness can be a kind of overindulgence or permissiveness, but also what he's talking about, kind of an unconditional love. He goes on, when you're young and have the feeling you're loved, you sort of feel it's the world loving you. The quality of that love gets turned around, and that's how you regard others. This, by the way, is why early family experiences, socialization, childcare even, are so important, is to reach children with this, to have them surrounded by a caring and loving when they're being formed, pays huge dividends later in life. Something so upside down about a society that spends a fortune on maintaining a prison population and so little on children, the care and support of children. Just from a financial perspective, it's so upside down. So if someone has been kind and generous and selfless to you once, you know the possibility exists. You internalize that. And in your future dealings with the world, you assume that's possible. Question. A couple of months after you gave this speech, it went viral on the internet. What was your reaction? Surprise, because on the day of the speech, it was no big deal. I think about a third of the kids were asleep. It wasn't a sensation, so I was gratified, but mystified. I didn't quite understand why I had that effect. Actually, I was happy the talk was only 8 minutes long, because I could tell a story about a failure of kindness and give a little idea of why it happened. If it had been a 20-minute speech, I had been in trouble. At 8 minutes, I could sort of say, hey, everyone, be kind. But the next step is really tricky. Let's say we all resolve to be kind. What do? That's where the real heavy spiritual lifting starts. How do we know in a given situation what would benefit somebody? How do we know that we're not just being big egotists and intruding when we aren't needed? The more I think about it, the more complicated it is. It's like a trap door opens and you get led to the really deep spiritual questions. It's really gratifying to see him take this matter of kindness to a deeper level here. You might maybe distinguish between showing kindness to people you don't know in like maybe a public situation or at school, who you don't know very well. That's one thing, and I think there it is pretty simple. It's when in doubt, just try to be simply kind, forgiving, helpful, forbearance. Forbearance is one of the six paramitas or perfections in Buddhism. Refers to the qualities that emerge from long practice and are to be cultivated, so they will continue to develop in us. The first of those, and arguably the foremost of the six paramitas, is dana, or giving. And then two or three later is forbearance, which basically means patience in the face of adversity or mistreatment. They're very, very much related. Dana and forbearance is giving in is a kind of giving. So I think this matter of kindness is a little bit easier, simpler, when we don't have a very close relationship to someone. But when we do, like a parent, parents with children, or a teacher with students, then it gets much more complicated. Because kindness can take the form of harshness, of correction of people. Parents have to know this. I can't speak as a parent, but I know in our house, my mother was the disciplinarian, the bad cop, and my father was the permissive, easygoing one, and so we kind of, as children, we tended to see her as bad and him as good, and it was only later that we saw what kindness there was in her disciplining us and her saying no and standing her ground and out of kindness, out of love. So what appears to be kindness can be a kind of neglect or indifference or a fear of confrontation, a fear of not being liked. That's my only concern about this stance of the author, and my concern also about the Dalai Lama's big emphasis on kindness, as well as the Vietnamese Buddhist Thich Nhat Hanh, is that it's so easy to misunderstand, even misuse kindness, when what's called for in any particular situation could be more harshness. And I think wanting to hear that the Dharma comes down to just kindness, that wanting that to be that simple is one explanation for why the Dalai Lama and Thich Nhat Hanh have such a huge popularity. To say, as Thich Nhat Hanh has many times, I don't know if he still says this, presumably he does, is to talk about just sweetness and flowers and children and smiles does not get to the real heart of the matter. In order to become kind, most of us, maybe all of us, have to plumb the darkness of our psyches. We have to get down in the muck and face our defilements, our afflictions, our greed, anger, and delusion. You can't bypass that stuff. If you do, it's just a superficial thing. You can hold up and when circumstances are pleasant enough and people are nice enough to you, then sure, you can be kind. But what has someone said? Virtue untested is no virtue at all. And that's the real work, is getting down and really mining our whole being and getting in touch with these dark sides of our nature. And everyone has dark sides. If you don't see a dark side, then you're missing something. The word, what he's referring to as kindness, the classic word in Buddhism is metta, M-E-T-T-A, usually translated as loving kindness. There's a whole form of meditation called metta meditation. People go on whole retreats, 9-day retreats, and do just metta meditation. The word metta literally means friendliness. And there's a sutra, the Metta Sutta. If anyone is confused about those two words, sutra is the Sanskrit, sutta is the Pali. The Pali language is the one used in the Buddhism of Southeast Asia, Theravadan Buddhism. In the Mahayana, that's Zen, we usually use the word sutra. Anyway, sutra, sutta, it's the metta, the discourse attributed to the Buddha. I thought I would read this. It's a little bit long, but if I can't read the Metta Sutta on Mother's Day, I don't know when I can. So this is there are, of course, all kinds of translations of these sutras, different differences in them. This is one translated from the Pali by the Amaravati Sangha. And this is how it goes. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Actually, I've sometimes considered using this prayer at midnight on New Year's Eve instead of a couple of other things we've done. Let's see, where were we? He's getting into the deeper layers of the more complexities of kindness. Roshi Kaplow used to quote Yasutani Roshi as saying, the job of a teacher is not just to reveal the truth, but to expose the false. And so, Roshi Kaplow, like Yasutani Roshi, could be quite harshly critical of certain teachers and others. It's a real fine line there. I do completely agree that there are times and places where we should speak up and expose the false. But then there are those who can hear that and think it's just some kind of rivalry or negativity. And it could be. That's the issue, is where is that coming from, that criticism, that fault-finding? Certainly in a teacher-student relationship, you have the bond of trust, at least theoretically, you have the bond of trust in which correction, and even harsh correction, can be a kindness for the student. It was an eye-opening experience for me when I went to Japan for 6 months and spent the first 3 months at Bukokuji, and the abbot was Tangen Roshi. It was quite amazing to me to see how unremittingly affirmative he was, affirming. I wasn't used to that at all. Roshi Kaplo, I wouldn't need five fingers to count the number of times he had praised me. I could do it on a thumb, maybe. that was his personality. He was being authentic, and I do believe that. Usually, it was coming from a place of really having my interests in mind and others. It wasn't just me. But he could be quite severe and quite harsh and critical and angry. I don't know. I don't think it's never been worth my trying to figure out how much of that was pure compassion and how much of it may have been the bad mood he might have been in. You know, teachers get in bad moods, by the way. Teachers are human. This is something that came to me pretty late with my relationship with him, that he had lifelong problems with sleeping. He would be sleep deprived often, and he would have stomach problems, and they were a lot better than they had been before he went to Japan for Zen training, but he had problems in his medical and his disposition generally, but it doesn't matter. What really counts is what we do with the criticism or the harshness from a teacher or a parent. That's more important. And if you can work with that, if you're not too sensitive and too reactive, then it can be the greatest medicine. I've heard that there were some Christian mystic, one of the desert fathers maybe, who would pay people to humiliate him. Whether that's really true, it doesn't matter. It's the spirit of it, that humiliation can be a great form of, powerful form of freeing one of one's attachment to the self, one's narcissistic tendencies. But at the same time, every teacher has his or her own way, and you can't very often. There's a place for that as a skillful means, but you can't generally contrive to be stern and harsh and critical if that's not really who you are. And that was what was so refreshing, is to see the Tangen Roshi would just lavish praise on people, and to the point of you're embarrassed. I suspect that possibly that with his closest disciples, the ordained people, he was harsher. And that comes back to this point about needing to have a viable, strong bond with a student before you can be sure that when you are harsh with her or him, that it's really going to be taken the right way, it can be used like that. There's also just a... No, I'm not going to go there. It's, for some of us, it's the easiest thing in the world to be kind. It's a way of avoiding conflict. It's a way of inflating your sense of spiritual development. If you have an image of yourself as a kind person, then every time you're kind to someone, it can be a kind of ego sustaining kind of thing. I'll just continue here. So he was just saying, how do we know in a given situation what would benefit somebody? How do we know that we're not just being big egotists and intruding when we aren't needed? The more I think about it, the more complicated it is. It's like a trap door opens and you get led to the really deep spiritual questions. And then the interviewer, since the Reagan era, there's been a concerted campaign to denigrate emotions such as kindness and compassion, things that Margaret Thatcher called wet, and promote more, quote, realistic values such as strength, competition, and tough-mindedness. Perhaps the response to your speech means people are hungry now for more kindness in their lives and in our society. And then Saunders, I think the American psyche right now is a bit like someone who has left their house and left something valuable behind. And even when we do talk about kindness, we do it with a bit of an apologetic wince. Certainly politicians do, but a human being without some kind of striving for kindness is really hobbled. It is hard to know how to live if kindness and sympathy and generosity are considered second-rate virtues. We're kind of not human beings in that case. So, even this can raise a question. If people exalt values that are counter to kindness, and they are, of course, endowed with this Buddha nature, then there's some. Why would they be that way? Why would they be extolling values of competition and hardness and all? Well, of course, because again, of fear. Something is confused in them. Something is misguided. Mean people are suffering. It's just that's a little mantra that can work to diffuse negative reaction to people who are behaving badly. Our tendencies as human beings, as someone is mistreating us, being hostile, is to want to react verbally or otherwise. But if we can just create a little space there of mindfulness and say something to ourselves like, mean people are suffering. This person is suffering. They're being mean only because they're suffering. They're deluded. It can neutralize our tendency to be angry. Another one, a little bit longer, and I forget who said this, but it stands on its own. I saw it on a plaque in a hotel, believe it or not, and this is what it said. Be kind. for everyone you meet is fighting a hard battle. Those are words to live by. In their own way, some kind of gnarled intra-psychic way, they're fighting their own battle. He goes on, it's really invigorating to just say it, you know, meaning about kindness. I'm a guy from the south side of Chicago. I've been in a lot of fights in my life, and I've done a lot of rough jobs, and I'm not afraid of being considered untough. It's kind of nice to say that these are indispensable virtues, and we can't go ahead without them. There's no point. Maybe it's some kind of blowback from the Reagan era, but when someone talks about kindness, we think of a bearded guy in a turtleneck sweater playing an acoustic guitar and kind of whining. But Martin Luther King Jr. and Nelson Mandela and all these great people weren't afraid to be quote-unquote weak. Lincoln was willing to be mocked, to take the lower place, to be patient with his enemies. There's that forbearance again. But really, he was the strongest person in the room. He could endure a lot of abuse if he knew that in the long run, his acceptance of that abuse would bring about a positive result. His gentleness and compassion and patience were all symptoms of his great strength. I remember Roshi Kapo telling the story, possibly only once, but it just stuck in my mind, where he was going through a tough period at the monastery, Hoshinji in Japan. He'd only been there for a year or two, and he had gone AWOL, slipped out of the monastery, and to go to the public baths. He was constantly cold in Japan, and he told me the only time he could get out from his constant cold was in bathwater, hot bathwater up to his neck, in the traditional Japanese style baths. So he went off to the public bath, and on his way back he ran into Harada Roshi, who he would sometimes describe as the old lion. And he thought his goose was cooked when he ran into him. And instead, he said, the Roshi just chatted with him briefly and then just kept going. Never said a thing. He must have known he didn't need to say anything, that Kaplo-san was mortified, was ashamed of having done this devious, sneaky thing. So in that situation, each situation is different. In that situation, what appeared to be kindness may have been real, true kindness, not just niceness, smiley face. It would be interesting to know if that had happened a second time, how the Roshi would have been. I know there were times when Roshi got very angry with me. I could swear there were sparks flying from his face when in these situations. And really, it seemed to be for me what was necessary to correct, to change my behavior, because it was just so painful to have him getting so angry at me. And then question, many people feel that we live in a dangerous world and we can't afford to let our guard down. And then Saunders, sometimes people say to me, in general, I agree with you about kindness, but what about Hitler? What about terrorists? I think we've been misled, and I see this all the time on the news, by this idea that we always have to be girding our loins for the next big showdown with somebody or other. we act as if the wolf is always at the door, so we've got a gun pointing out the window. But actually, the wolf is not that often at the door, so we can afford to go a little easy. 99% of the time, if you just do your best to be kind, you're better off. It's the basic things, like trying to have good manners, keeping your assumptions about the other person a little open, being willing to revise your opinion. And even these are pretty tricky. The times when you're asked to do something about Hitler are pretty few and far between. Yeah, he's making the point that this is, what about Hitler? I got you there. It's so abstract. It's so hypothetical. Just look at your own life and the way you, people you interact with day in and day out. You don't need to be thinking about the most extreme, rare kind of freak like Hitler or those other guys. One of the things that fascinates me about the gun control debate is that every time there's a school shooting or a public shooting of some kind, some of us will say, what more evidence do you need for more gun control? Whereas others, those who worship the NRA, those on the other side, will see every shooting as evidence that we need more guns! We need more guns to protect ourselves! Can't you see? It's so simple. It's maddeningly airtight. How do we bridge that gap every time there's a shooting? See, there it is. Evidence right there. That's right. We need more guns to protect ourselves. You don't have to be have a PhD in psychology to know that the people who see hostility in others have some work to do on their own hostility. That's where this starts, is the inner work, the meditation, is coming to terms with our own hostility. If we can do that, then there's a much better chance that we won't be seeing it menacing us everywhere we go. He says, I'm 55 years old and I've lived in a lot of circumstances, high and low, and I've never gotten into a really extreme situation. When I've come close and had the presence of mind to err on the side of negotiation and humanizing the situation, it's always gone better than when I've tried to steer toward confrontation. I keep in mind that quote from The Philadelphia Story, I think it's a Tom Hanks movie, the time to make up your mind about other people is never. That's a beautiful line. The time to make up your mind about other people is never. So I try to almost mechanically remind myself of that, to see when my resistance or temper flares up, or when I find myself pigeonholing somebody. That would take up most of our life, just to try to do that much. Question. Perhaps it's a self-fulfilled prophecy. We live in an unkind world because we believe it's an unkind world. It's not exactly a question, but Saunders' response. The thing I've noticed is that if you go out into the world ready for confrontation, then confrontations find you. But if you go out with a sort of diffusing energy, the world reads that and feels more friendly toward you. So I think there's a circular effect. Again, the need for meditation on a daily basis, the need for the inner work, is because you can't fake this. You can't just decide to go out and be pleasant and non-threatening if you haven't done the work, if you haven't rooted out the hostility in yourself. It takes time, it takes work for people to really respond to real benevolent bearing and countenance. He goes on, in the media and in our political rhetoric, we're told, don't be a sucker, be firm, be strong, push back, they're trying to get you. If you buy into that, even on a molecular level, the world smells it on you. Whereas, and here's where it sounds corny, the world responds to you differently if you go out thinking, all right, I'm going to pretend that everybody out there is my brother or sister, and if they are temporarily behaving like they're not, I'm going to pretend that they're just confused. I'm going to insist through my mannerisms and my tone of voice that I see them at their highest. Okay, now, that's the other side of things, is if we can consciously, mindfully frame other people in that way, even if we haven't rooted out our hostility, our anger, it can. This is the second best thing, is it can make a difference. It reminds me of the fascinating matter of acting on stage or in movies. In acting, you have to inhabit a certain emotion, and in having to do that, you experience it. You become it, at least temporarily. He says, I don't mean to be naive. There are obviously times when a person has to stand their ground, but I would argue that the best form of standing your ground is to be gentle. It often takes a lot more guts to be gentle than it does to be confrontational. Question, to what extent was your speech inspired by your Buddhist practice, or was it simply a reflection of who you are as a human being? And he says, hard to distinguish between the two, I guess. I'm really a beginner, but I do try to keep my ears open, and that was a place where my actual experience and the tenets of Buddhism suddenly came together. In my writing work, I've noticed that if you do anything with real intensity and with a real interest in the truth of the matter, then it ends up being dharmic somehow. Whether it's basketball or photography or whatever, if you're really, really interested in the truth, then you'll end up with something that looks and feels very much like Dharma, it seems to me. Yet you do offer some specific Buddhist analysis. You told the students that we fail to be kind because of three fundamental misunderstandings about who we are. We believe that we're the center of the universe, that we're separate from the universe, and that we're permanent. These are classic Buddhist definitions of ego. And he said, originally I had laden this section with some Buddhist terms, but my wife said, he's referring to his book that just came out, but my wife said I should take them out. She said I shouldn't make it seem overthought or dogmatic. And of course, the dharmic ideas are so beautiful and pure that anyone who had lived and experienced these things would see the basic truth of them. Because for me, that's what dharma is. Really, really trying to get to the bottom of this with no deflection and no confusion and no agenda. I was at a conference of the Dalai Lama where he confided that when he gives these big, big ceremonies where thousands of people come, there's one called the Dharma Chakra. He says they're not. It's an initiation ceremony. He said they're. It's not really an initiation. It's just exposing them to the Dharma. That's I would consider it skillful means. Last question. This points to one of Buddhism's great strengths. It doesn't simply tell us to be kind. It shows us in concrete terms why we're not, which gives us a path forward. And Saunders, that to me is the most wonderful thing about any vital spiritual practice. It doesn't necessarily stop doing that. Or if it does, it says, here's how to stop doing that. Because you can only get so good with sheer willpower. You have to look into the way things actually work to empower yourself to do better. Here's a wonderful metaphor I sometimes use with my students. You're on a cruise ship and the surface is made of ice and you're carrying 6 trays and you're wearing roller skates and you're drunk. And so is everybody else. So nobody's the boss and the situation is unstable. There's no fixed point. That's pure Buddhism itself. When I think of life that way, it sums up the proper level of mercy and tolerance. We really don't know what's going on, so our feeling of sympathy or empathy is related to our mutual lostness. Everybody's lost at once. All right, we'll stop now and recite the 4 vows.